I remember the way the parking lot looked before anyone told me what had happened, because the scene did not announce itself the way violence usually does, with chaos or noise or movement, but instead with a stillness that felt arranged, as if everything had stopped in the exact positions it occupied when the last decision was made. And as I stood there reviewing the first photographs and the first written observations, I could tell this was not a random place for a man to die, nor a moment that arrived without preparation, because the setting itself carried intention in the quiet order of vehicles, the proximity to the building meant for worship, and the absence of anything resembling chance. I had handled enough cases to know that when a killing happens in a place people associate with safety and routine, the truth rarely lives in the moment itself, but instead stretches backward through personal histories, private conflicts, and choices made long before a trigger is pulled. And as I followed the paperwork and recordings tied to this scene, the pattern that emerged was not one of sudden rage, but of a dispute that had been tightening over time, narrowing until there was only one possible release. The man who died that night was Pastor Eric Moses. Before the parking lot became evidence and before the church grounds were cordoned off with tape, Eric Moses was known primarily in the way pastors often are, through the routines they keep and the consistency they project to the people around them, because his public life was built on presence, on showing up, and on being seen as someone whose role was study rather than dramatic. In the records I reviewed, including employment documents, community statements, and prior correspondence, Moses appeared as a figure whose days followed predictable patterns, shaped by ministry obligations and personal relationships that extended beyond the church itself. From what I personally handled, it was clear that Moses' role placed him in regular contact with members of his congregation, and with people whose connections to him were not purely spiritual, because churches are not isolated environments, and the lives that intersect there often carry unresolved tensions that have nothing to do with faith. Financial records and communications showed overlapping relationships that blurred personal and professional boundaries, which is not unusual in small or close-knit religious communities, but can become significant when conflict enters the picture. In the months leading up to his death, documented interactions revealed strain in at least one personal relationship that was no longer stable, and while I am careful to rely only on what was confirmed through statements and records, it was evident that this strain had progressed beyond disagreement into something that required attention. Text messages and call logs demonstrated repeated attempts at contact, some initiated by Moses and others by individuals connected to him, indicating a situation that had not resolved itself, quietly. What mattered to the investigation was not speculation about emotion, but the concrete trail left behind, including schedules, vehicle movements, and the timing of meetings that placed Moses in predictable locations at predictable times. The church parking lot, in particular, was not an unusual destination for him, because it was part of his routine, and that routine was known to people outside the congregation as well. I reviewed witness statements that described Moses as approachable and consistent, someone who did not alter his habits dramatically even when personal matters became complicated, which in hindsight mattered because it meant his movements remained easy to anticipate. Predictability, while not a flaw in character, often becomes a vulnerability when conflict escalates beyond conversation. The dispute that later became central to the case did not begin with violence, and nothing in the early documentation suggested immediate danger, but there was evidence of unresolved resentment tied to romantic involvement and interpersonal boundaries that had been crossed. Statements given to investigators confirmed that multiple parties were aware of the tension, even if they did not anticipate how it would end. From my review of prior incident reports, there were no documented threats that met the legal threshold for intervention, which meant that law enforcement had no formal record suggesting Moses was an imminent risk. This absence of formal warning is important because it explains why no protective measures were in place and why the events unfolded without interruption. As I reconstructed the days before the shooting, using calendar entries and confirmed sightings, Moses' life appeared outwardly unchanged, with services conducted, meetings attended, and communications maintained in a manner consistent with his role. There was no deviation significant enough to raise alarms, and nothing in the verified record showed an attempt to disengage from the situation that would later define the case. The people closest to him, according to their statements, believed the conflict was manageable. And while hindsight makes that belief seem misplaced, the evidence shows it was sincere. In true crime work, I have learned that escalation often hides behind normalcy, and this case followed that pattern with precision. By the time the final meeting occurred, the groundwork had already been laid through months of unresolved issues, overlapping relationships, and decisions that narrowed available options. None of that was visible in the parking lot itself, but every document I reviewed pointed back to that buildup as the necessary context for understanding what happened next. The shooting itself was captured not through eyewitness spectacle, but through a combination of surveillance footage, audio recordings, and physical evidence that allowed investigators to reconstruct the sequence without relying on assumption. I reviewed the footage personally, frame by frame, noting vehicle positions, movement patterns, and the absence of bystanders at the critical moment. According to confirmed timestamps from the surveillance system, Moses arrived in the parking lot at a time consistent with his established routine, parking his vehicle in an area that offered no concealment and no indication that he expected confrontation. The footage showed no hesitation in his movements, which aligned with witness accounts that he believed the encounter, if one occurred, would remain verbal. What followed was brief, and the lack of prolonged interaction on the recording underscored how quickly the situation transitioned from presence to violence. The shooter approached with purpose, and there was no evidence of a prolonged argument or physical struggle prior to the gunfire, which mattered because it contradicted any notion of a spontaneous escalation at the scene. Audio analysis confirmed multiple shots fired in rapid succession, with intervals consistent with controlled trigger pulls rather than erratic discharge. This detail was significant in determining intent, and it aligned with the physical evidence recovered from the scene, including shell casings positioned in a pattern that indicated the shooter remained stationary. Moses was struck and collapsed near his vehicle, and the footage showed no attempt by the shooter to render aid or remain at the scene beyond the seconds required to carry out the act. The departure was immediate, reinforcing the conclusion that this was not an impulsive act, but one executed with a clear objective. Emergency response records showed that first responders arrived quickly, but the injuries sustained were fatal, and Moses was pronounced dead after life-saving measures failed. I reviewed those reports alongside the medical examiner's findings, which confirmed the cause of death and ruled out any contributing factors beyond the gunshot wounds. The surveillance footage became central to the case, not because it dramatized the event, but because it removed ambiguity about what occurred, leaving investigators to focus on the question of why, rather than how. When violence is recorded so clearly, it strips away speculation and forces attention onto motive and premeditation, both of which must be established through evidence. As the investigation progressed, the recordings were corroborated by phone location data and vehicle tracking information that placed the shooter at the scene and documented movements before and after the shooting. I reviewed these records in conjunction with the footage, confirming that the timeline held together without gaps. The confrontation, if it can be called that, lasted only moments, and there was no evidence that Moses initiated or escalated it. This mattered legally and factually, because it framed the killing as an act carried out upon him, rather than an exchange between parties. By the time the scene was cleared and the evidence logged, the parking lot had transformed from a place of routine into a fixed point in an evidentiary chain, and every item collated there served to reinforce the same conclusion. The act was deliberate, targeted, and rooted in conflict that existed long before the first shot was fired. After the shooting, the investigation shifted from reconstruction to accountability, and the focus turned to assembling a case that relied entirely on verifiable facts rather than interpretation. I reviewed arrest records, charging documents, and court filings that laid out the legal response to Moses' death. The evidence presented established a clear sequence of actions supported by video, audio, and forensic analysis, leaving little room for dispute about the mechanics of the crime. What remained to be addressed in court was the motive, which prosecutors tied to documented personal relationships and confirmed disputes rather than conjecture. Throughout the legal process, Moses' role as a pastor remained part of the public narrative, but in the courtroom, the emphasis stayed on the evidence, because the law does not weigh profession when determining responsibility. I observed how the case moved forward on that principle, with each filing anchored to documentation already reviewed during the investigation. Sentencing and case resolution, as reflected in official records, brought the legal proceedings to a close, but they did not resolve the broader impact of the killing, which extended into the community and the congregation Moses had served. Victim impact statements and community responses were preserved in transcripts, offering factual insight into the consequences without editorializing. In reviewing the final outcomes, I noted that the case did not hinge on a single piece of evidence but on the convergence of many, all of which told the same story when examined together. This convergence is what ultimately defines successful investigations, not dramatic moments but consistency across records. What remains in the file now is a complete account, from routine movements to irreversible action, preserved in documents, recordings, and court decisions. Moses' death is fixed in those records as a homicide carried out in a place associated with trust and routine, a fact that remains unchanged regardless of interpretation. As an investigator, my role ended when the case reached its legal conclusion, and what remains for me is the responsibility to present it accurately, without embellishment and without omission. The facts stand as they were recorded, and they do not require amplification to convey their weight. Eric Moses died in a church parking lot in Texas in 2022, and the evidence shows that his death was the result of a deliberate act rooted in a documented personal dispute, resolved not through reconciliation but through violence, as confirmed by the official record.